And hello to all of you out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network. I'm your host, Brandon Davis. And it's a new year here at the Front Row and a new year of classics. And not only is it a new year, it's Oscar time. So what better way to start off Oscar season than to talk about the Best Picture winner of 1960, which is Billy Wilder's The Apartment. And this is a movie that's been one of my favorites for a long time. And just is great for a lot of discussion here. And I have joining me once again, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
It's going really well. How's it going with you, Brandon?
Not too bad. Not too bad. It's you and I were just talking. We survived the snow, although Aaron's far more north of us. So I bet. Did you get dumped, Aaron?
It wasn't as bad as the media made it out to be. So, I mean, very typical Chicago snow. We're all surviving. We're all fine. Our streets are plowed.
Good. And actually, I kind of buried the lead, but this is the first time, Aaron, I've been on a podcast with you. So I'm excited here. So let's just get started here with discussing the movie. 1960, directed by Billy Wilder, written and directed by Wilder, and co-written by his long co-writing partner, I.A.L. Diamond. Kind of hard to place it in a certain genre. It usually gets put in the comedy genre, but this is, I mean, I think it's far much more a poignant drama than anything else. It's got comedic elements. But Aaron, I know this was your first time seeing it. What were your first impressions?
I haven't dove into any like classics in a while,
nice.
In a long time. So it was fun to go back with like, you know, the complexity of movies out now, how much this movie said it with like, with its simplicity. Uh-huh. I really enjoyed that part of it, and that with a lot of subtle tones could really take me on like an emotional roller coaster.
Nice. Eric, what were your first impressions?
Yeah, real similar. So I probably saw this movie for the first time 25 years ago. So it was a lot of fun to go back and visit it and sort of have a different lens on history. But this movie, I think, Brandon, you kind of hit the nail on the head. Kind of hard to pin it down in the genre. And it's a strange little film for its time, too. When you look at the other Best Picture winners in sort of the years around it, it's the Ben-Hurs and the West Side Stories and Bridge on the River Kwai, which are all these great big movies. And this is, Aaron, you said it, it's a small story, but it says so much. So it's kind of a strange thing in 1960. There's movie going out on television. In fact, you see it in this movie, that the small screen sort of dominating the entertainment culture, and the movies are just they're still the movies. They're still the old Hollywood, and they're still sort of the post-war optimism. And then to have something like this that comes along that tackles some very heavy subjects is a little strange, but in a really refreshing way.
What's interesting to me about this is this comes out in 1960. The production code that's ruled Hollywood for decades is starting to lose momentum. So you can get away with different kinds of storytelling finally. And so it seems pretty tame today, but this was, I read a couple of critic reviews from back in that time, and some of them referred to it as a dirty fairy tale. And so... which really, I mean, if you think about it, this for a movie that's been released in 1960, when you think about all that came before it, you know, with all of the affairs and everything that are going on in the apartments, and no one's questioning the morality of it. It's basically just how toxic it is in terms of Jack Lemmon's world. And so being able to sort of have more of the freedom of that kind of storytelling really was different for 1960. And I think that that's part of what sort of propelled this movie into being the classic that it is.
There's a lot of talking about, I mean, obviously the whole movie is about, like you said, extramarital affairs and their effects, and clearly about sex.
Yeah.
There's, but never once is it shown. It's only alluded to. Like, so it, I don't know, so different than the movies now. Like, you know, it's bare all in 2020, 2019, and this, like, not a thing.
Yeah. What's interesting is Billy Wilder took inspiration from this from kind of a true story. There was a producer in Hollywood named Walter Wanger, whose wife was apparently having an affair with another producer in Hollywood, found it out and found them together in one of his subordinates' apartments. So that was a scandal around Hollywood. Billy Wilder said, you know, I think there's a movie there of what goes on in some of these apartments. And also, this was around the time in New York City when hotel detectives started becoming a thing. So if you wanted to have, you know, an afternoon rendezvous with a secretary or something like that, you couldn't go to a hotel anymore because hotel detectives were putting the crackdown on it. So you had to go to a private residence like an apartment or something.
Wait, hold on. Tell me about hotel detectives. I know nothing of this.
Yeah. A lot of hotels felt they were losing respectability because of these Park Avenue businessmen who would take mistresses in there for just an afternoon or something. And then that led to prostitution around the hotels and all that stuff. So they hired these hotel detectives to go around and knock on doors and see if you were with your wife or not.
Oh my gosh.
And so all of these goings on are kind of what inspired this movie. But what I love is, like I said, this is a genre-defying movie. It's not a comedy. It's not a drama. It's like a little slice of life, and I love it. And I love the fact that you know, Billy Wilder, having just come off of making Some Like It Hot the year before, which was, you know, a screwball comedy, a huge hit. He could have capitalized on that big time. And instead, he opted to do a much smaller story that actually, you know, doesn't really leave you laughing a whole lot.
I would say maybe that this fits into the realm of satire, where he's saying, I'm going to shine a light on this thing that was probably actually really fairly common and make fun of it, but also bring it to light and make commentary on it. So it was a bold choice coming right off of something like Some Like It Hot.
And there was a lot of cleverness to it in the dialogue. Very subtle cleverness, like, you know, we can get into it later, but I noticed that right off the bat. I was like, oh, this is witty. With that. And so I understand how people see the comedy component of it because of just the dialogue alone. But you're right. The subject matter is very serious, but everyone in the movie, like the men of the movie, are so flippant with it all. And I think that is to showcase how it was affairs in that age were approached. Very much like, well, this is just what happens. Even the women were flippant with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And knew that, you know, the men were terrible. There's the comment, the one woman that works at the office says, well, I was hoping he'd take me out for a night's dinner and we went to a burger joint instead.
Yeah.
I think that describes exactly what you're saying.
And what I love is the fact that he's setting this around like the holiday season when days are much darker. You're going to work in the dark. You're coming home in the dark. There's a lot more isolation going on. The weather is cold outside. And the fact that Jack Lemmon is so isolated, he can't even go home. he has to sit, you know, on a park bench or, you know, do something else, you know, with the first couple hours he gets off work. And so there's kind of a solitary emphasis on, especially him and Shirley MacLaine's character, which we'll get into. But that's a good segue. Let's go into talking about the characters and the cast. Jack Lemmon, first of all, is one of my favorite actors. I mean, he could do comedy, drama, whatever you ask of him. And he's such an everyman. If you had cast somebody else who was big at the time, like a Paul Newman or, you know, Cary Grant, someone else in that part, I don't think it would have worked as well because he just comes across as, you know, this everyman who's wanting to do right, who's wanting to climb the ladder, but for some reason by his choice is deciding to follow these office politics and just, you know, allowed himself to sort of get dredged in the mud of what's going on here.
Yeah. And he's, he's firing on all cylinders. He's really funny in this movie. There are the scenes of him in the bar are just amazing. And he is funny without even saying a whole lot. He's funny with just the looks that he's giving. And then he's also carrying the water in the dramatic scenes too. I mean, he does everything in this movie. And I don't know. I know he won the Academy Award for this, but I don't know if this is one that people point to and say that's one of his greatest movies, but they should. I think it's underrated in that way.
Actually, no, he didn't win the Oscar for this.
Oh, that's right. He was nominated.
Yeah, so I forget who he lost to. I'll look that up here in a second. But yeah, I just, you know, for him to, throughout the 50s, he was known as this sort of slapstick screwball guy who really, you know, was just, especially when you look at his performance in Some Like It Hot the year before, which he was also nominated for an Oscar for. But this is sort of the movie that cemented him as kind of a guy who could provide great pathos in every performance, who could be both funny and sentimental at the same time. Aaron, what are your thoughts about Jack Lemmon?
His character was great. Like he did such a great job that I was so annoyed to see Baxter the entire time because of exactly what you're saying. Like he's going back and forth. He can't decide, you know, he's sentimental. You can see he has a huge heart, but he's also such a people pleaser and he balances that and, oscillates between both of those really well through the whole film, which I'm sure for an actor is really difficult to do, but for somebody who spent, like you said, a large portion of their career in comedy, he really shows some drama chops here.
Yeah. And what's so great about him is, you know, he knows what he's doing is, you know, not right. And he knows that what he's doing is right. He just doesn't know how to get out of it. And he's dug himself so deep. You know, where I get frustrated with him is that he's allowing his neighbors to think that he's this sort of Don Juan bachelor and he doesn't do anything to ever correct that. And they never, and even toward the end, they don't know that he's really this genuine good guy.
And I was wondering why he was doing that a little bit. And the conclusion that I came up to was maybe he knows that the explanation's not much better. You know, hey, I'm letting these other guys.
Oh, God, yeah.
Right? Does that make some sense?
Right.
Yeah.
He didn't feel like it might as well just let them think bad of me about and let them think I'm this Casanova rather than let them think bad of me that I'm just this guy trying to get ahead at work and letting other people cheat on their wives.
Right. Right. And I just
hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah. And, you know, and of course the whole aspect of it that, you know, it's all sort of boiled down into when he looks at that crack in the mirror and he sees that, you know, he's been two-faced this whole time and that, you know, the person that he's trying to be doesn't match up with what he sort of is allowing himself to be. But I think that that whole character is just so interesting. And the fact that Lemmon is able to walk that line and make you laugh, make you frustrated and just sort of have that whole character arc that he has, you know, it's a very special actor who can do that.
Yeah. He was, it was so frustrating to watch him be a sellout and at every turn I kept rooting for him. That was the thing too. They created this character and he created this character where it was like, this guy was a sellout. He was clearly doing the wrong thing. But at every turn I was rooting for him still to just do the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that he finds genuine love with the Shirley MacLaine character with Fran, you know, and he can't do anything about it because both he and her have made this choice to get so involved in, you know, the goings on in the office and in the office politics. And, you know, and he finally has sort of his out and he doesn't take it right away. And that gets him to in an even greater mess. So,
yeah.
So any other thoughts about Jack Lemmon before we move on? All right. Well, let's talk about the other lead in this movie, Shirley MacLaine as Fran Kubelik. And I love Shirley MacLaine. She's one of my favorites. And to see her here, you know, and at sort of the peak of her powers, you know, when she had just sort of taken Hollywood by storm a few years before, she has such a unique... unique look, unique persona to her. And I love that they don't make her character sort of this ditzy office worker that, you know, you would have seen probably back then. They make her, she very much has a head on her shoulders. She knows what she's doing, but she sort of for a while doesn't care until it all sort of comes crumbling down on her. But I love her very sort of passé-ness that you see at the beginning. She's sort of resigned herself to her situation.
She was a stark contrast to him in the beginning of C.C. Baxter had no boundaries. He had no self-respect. He's letting everyone walk all over him. And then she comes in and she seems to have very good boundaries. And even so, she's in, you know, this really, you find out she's in a relationship with somebody in the office. But even then, like, very much I can relate to her in the sense of, and I've got a best friend like this where it's like, well, I'm not lying to anybody, so why would anyone be lying to me? And then that way, like that punch in the gut when you find out that someone is lying to you or that someone's two-timing you.
Yeah. And she plays it with both a strength and a vulnerability at the same time that, I'm not sure that many other people can pull that off. She's obviously not dumb. She's got her wits about her, but parts broke at the same time. And it comes through so well in how she plays it.
Oh, yeah. This film really took me on an emotional roller coaster. Like, I was so sad. And part of it definitely was the orchestration as well. Like the music was wonderful. But I was like heartbroken when she ditched him outside of Music Man. And then, when she opens the mirror, when he gives her $100, like we can get to that, but when she opens the mirror or when she gets the $100 and you're watching her emotion, it was heartbreaking. It really was. She was adorable in this movie and totally, yes, strong. And I loved everything. I really loved her character a lot.
Yeah, it makes me, anytime I go to New York, I hope I walk into an elevator and have someone like Shirley MacLaine be my operator. There's such a, she has this sort of optimistic cheeriness that sort of is holding down, you know, all of her insecurities. And it's really, really fun, you know, to see her play all those different emotions. And yeah, I was going to say, you know, when Sheldrake hands her that $100 and just the look on her face, that says it all right there. But I love, just all the little aspects and how she's, you know, he's more willing to express his emotions to her than she is toward him and toward the end, you know, which is of course the whole ending line, which we'll get into and all that. But the whole gin game between the two of them and how casual their relationship is and how they're growing. That's an interesting aspect that Billy Wilder didn't have the gin game written into the script. He was waiting to see how he wanted to wrap things up, but Shirley MacLaine, performing in Vegas back then, was becoming great friends with Sinatra and Dean Martin, and they were teaching her how to play gin on the weekends. And so he would see her playing that off stage, and he said, well, you know, let's work that in. So that's how the gin game, you can thank the Rat Pack for teaching her how to play gin. But
that's fabulous.
Like I said, the fact that it's so unusual to see a character like this at that time, who has a head on her shoulders and who's very much aware of the situation around her. And she's heartbreaking, but you know, even though she attempts suicide at one point, you know that in the end she's going to be okay because she's got that resilience about her, especially toward the end when she, you know, makes that final decision to just walk away from Sheldrake.
This movie made me unsure if like she wasn't gonna like if the suicide wasn't gonna go through. I again was really shocked. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe the turn this is taking, and this is like kind of getting Alfred Hitchcocky, where he's gonna walk in and the irony is now she's dead in his apartment. And just the whole thing really surprised me. Like it kept me on my toes, and like, and especially emotionally. Yeah, I was just super impressed by that.
Yeah. Like I said, Wilder always subverts your expectations in these movies. And I think that's why his movies remain so fresh to this day. It's because they were never cookie cutter. And I love that. Let's go on to the third major player here, and then we'll get into all the little supporting characters who are our favorites or whatever. But Sheldrake, played by Fred McMurray. And what's so interesting about Fred McMurray is Billy Wilder somehow always saw the dark side of Fred McMurray when no one else did. Because in the 40s, he was the king of romantic comedies, and he casts him as a murderer in Double Indemnity. And then at this point, he's Mr. Disney doing The Absent-Minded Professor and Shaggy Dog, and he gets cast as this philandering boss. And it's just amazing to see. As a matter of fact, I read a story where Fred McMurray was doing promotions at Disneyland for one of the Disney movies he was in, and a lady came up and hit her with a purse.
Understandably so. While I was watching it, I was like, the only word I can use to describe this man is scoundrel.
I know.
He was just awful.
He has this all-American dad persona about him.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden the darkness creeps out and you see what this guy is capable of and what he's done and the long line of women he's left behind. And
it's every character that he interacts with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He
treats with such a flippant indifference. You end up thinking that guy doesn't care about anyone or anything. And McMurray plays it so well. He comes across with the big smile, and you know, I remember him from My Three Dads, and it was America's Dad, and just to see him just oozing this greasiness is off-putting in so many ways, and makes you squirm in that good way too. He's a great villain in this.
Yeah, the scene that always comes to mind with him is when Bud is on the phone with him on Christmas morning and, you know, letting him know what Fran has done. And, you know, the fact that, you know, of course, he's surrounded by his wife and kids, and he can't show any kind of worry or any kind of affection or any kind of, you know, just human dignity towards Fran in that moment. And he leaves it all up to Bud here in this moment. And you realize, man, this is who this guy is, and he's not budging at all.
Yeah, he tells his wife, why do they have to bother me with this on Christmas Day? He's the victim here, you know? I mean,
oh my gosh. Yeah. And I think you raise a good point in asking the question, was he suppressing and repressing his emotions? He did care, or was he really just like, I don't care, just make it go away? Like, he seemed annoyed by it.
Yeah.
He seemed annoyed that she tried to take her life. Wow. It had been a while. It's been a while since I watched a movie where I really was like kind of tricked into even not liking this person in real life. Like, I might hit him with the purse too. Which is a sign of a fabulous and of a fantastic actor.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, what I love about his portrayal is just that, you know, this whole setup that everybody has with Bud, it's so tight, and there can't be anything that goes wrong. And so when stuff does go wrong, you know, he's got to shut it down right away. And, you know, and he's so slick. And, you know, I think about that first scene when he's on his secret date with her at that little restaurant. You know, and the fact, you know, as soon as someone they know come in, they got to sneak out and all that stuff. And of course they end up getting caught. But, you know, he just is so smarmy and slick, and he has all of his bad deeds planned down, like right to the second.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the choice of the way they introduce him as sort of the moral police for the company, and then revealing his true colors slowly by negotiating this deal is just an excellent choice, I thought, too.
And they set that up so well, because you have those opening scenes where it's Lemon and all of sort of the other managers in the firm there. And you think that maybe, you know, McMurray is the boss, is going to be, you know, sort of the good guy in the situation. Then you realize, well, he's the top sleaze here in the company. Right.
He's the worst one.
Yeah.
I think the scene that killed me the most, maybe with him, was at the end, close to the end, when Jack Lemmon is going to march into his office and, you know, tell him that he's going to take Fran off of his hands and he loves her. And he basically, Sheldrake basically says the same thing to him, like, you don't have to worry about Fran anymore. I'm going to take my hands off her. And then it's like, yeah, my wife kicked me out, and then kind of explains what he's going to do. And when he went on that, he was going to go back to Fran, but he was also going to enjoy being a bachelor. It was like my stomach started turning. I was like, oh, like it just, I didn't think it could get worse. Like this woman was so distraught over you, she almost took her life, and you're feeding her all of these lies, and then your other wife, or your wife, left you, and now you're going to enjoy being a bachelor.
He had no intentions of making any of it right. You know,
not at all.
No, and he really, like I said, for a guy who spent most of his career playing these wonderful good guy dads, he plays a great villain. And I'm sure it was a really, you know, it's like what we were talking about with Knives Out, how it must have been a great release for Chris Evans to play this jerk. It must have been a great release for him to play these kind of roles. But let's get into, there's a couple great little smaller character roles that I just love in this movie. And I love Jack Christian, who plays the next door neighbor, the doctor, probably the only person who's actually a full human being, or a mensch, as he says in the movie.
Yes.
But just so full of warmth, so great. You know, the scene where they're trying to wake her up with all the coffee and everything, he's fantastic.
Oh my God, can we please talk about that? Because I could not believe how much slapping there was.
I know. And he really slapped her.
Oh, I mean, he kept slapping. Yes, he kept doing it. I'm like, this is superfluous. Like, yeah. Oh, he's going to slap her again. Like, it kept happening. He was fabulous.
Yeah. And the actress who plays his wife is great too. And that little scene she has feeding her the chicken soup.
Yeah.
It's like the two people who have the only moral compass in the whole movie.
Well, look what a mess he's gotten himself into.
I know.
That he is the only one who's doing the right thing for her. Mm-hmm. He's the only one in this world, in this city at this point, who's caring for her and trying to help her and doing the right thing. But because he hasn't stood up for himself, because he's still, like, because he was covering up for other people's crap, the neighbors were sitting there trying to talk her out of it, being like, he's the jerk, he's the worst. Like, I thought that was very interesting how they did that.
Yeah, there's go ahead.
And the neighbors, they still invite Bud to come over to their apartment too. I mean, they the worst of him, and they still say, hey, come on over, we're having this party, just, you know, I when he comes in to borrow some ice, why don't you join us? I mean, they're the greatest people and the greatest neighbors. You would want to live next door to folks like that, and just great performances too. And I believe Dr. Dreyfuss, the actor that played him, did win the Academy Award for that, though.
Now he got a supporting actor nomination.
Okay.
I'm looking at there weren't any actors that won the Oscars for this movie, which I'm surprised about. But yeah, he did get a supporting actor nomination, which is great.
Well deserved. Yeah. And it's probably for that scene where he's trying to wake up the Shirley MacLaine character. I mean, there's just an intensity there, and he's obviously been in that character's obviously been in that situation before. And comes in, knows what to do, and he's just a man about his work. You know, if I've got to slap her face, I've got to do it. He just does it.
Yeah, he was in the zone.
Yeah, absolutely. The one of the other smaller characters that really stands out in this movie is Miss Olson, Sheldrake's secretary, played by Edie Adams. She's got a couple small scenes, but she really makes an impression. And I think it's the way that they designed her look, as well as just, just that she's scheming the whole time and that she's out for revenge, and that whole scene where she gets fired and then calls Sheldrake's wife to meet her for lunch. I mean, the fact that you don't even see that lunch that they have, but you know what she said and what went on. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Her glasses give her the cat's eyes that, you know, see everything. Yeah. You know that right through those frames, everything is being seen. So.
Well, and I think the way they played her, it was unclear to me on if she was giving information to Fran to hurt Fran or to enlighten her, you're going to get hurt too. And even like when she caught them in the restaurant, it was unclear. And then until she called the wife and said, let me tell you what he's doing. Like, and obviously she had the conversation with him to say, you know, you're leaving all these other girls behind. You've done this to me. I didn't know if her jealousy was making her mess with the other relationships or if she was trying to get him in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. And also I just think she's someone who has no filter and doesn't care about how she presents any information.
Yeah.
But yeah, just any other small characters that stand out to you in the movie?
The woman he tries to go home with. I just thought that was just comical. And that was when I was like, gosh, this movie is funny. Like, I didn't understand why they had the whole conversation about Cuba. I was like, how interesting.
Because you've got Shirley MacLaine taking pills and then it cuts over to her doing this little drunken spiel about Castro.
Yeah, about her husband. And, you know, I was like, wow, that was such interesting writing too. Like, they could have just written her husband in jail, but they decided to put this whole bit about Cuba and Fidel Castro in there.
Oh, and I love that her husband's not even politically active. He's a jockey. It's really funny writing.
It's great, right?
So I was amused by her and all of the like female characters, just in how they portrayed, like many of them were just as flippant and okay with the affairs as the men were. Like, oh yeah, this is just what happens. Men have affairs, you know, boys will be boys kind of thing. And I'm just here for the moment and that's it.
Yeah, it's got great, even the smallest parts in this movie are all cast so well because they all stand out. They've all got memorable faces and you just remember them. You were talking about Mrs. McDougal, the lady he takes home. I love their cheek to cheek dancing where they're literally just cheek to cheek.
That's the part. Size. Yeah, great.
And to prep for this, I watched the little documentary on the Blu-ray that I have, and they interview her because she's still living. And she was saying that with Billy Wilder, his scripts were so airtight that they wouldn't let you change like a single word. They said, you know, they let Lemon improvise with some of the physical stuff, but she said there's that scene on the front stoop before they actually go up into the apartment, and she has the line that, I think it's her husband who's like a chihuahua or something like that, that she says. And she said that she kept saying kind of like a chihuahua, and they cut like, I don't know, four or five times until she just said like a chihuahua. They said, no, when you say kind of, that ruins the rhythm of our line. So, so they said, you did not change a word of a Billy Wilder script, but when you have superb writing like that, you know, I guess who can blame them?
Yeah. I did love that her physicality matches Jack Lemmon's in that bar scene. I mean, she stands toe-to-toe with him in physical comedy and did a great job there.
Yeah, she took her moment and went with it.
Absolutely. I'm a big Ray Walston fan, too.
Oh, Ray Walston, yeah.
He plays one of the managers who's an apartment user, mm-hmm. which you know, a certain group of listeners to this are going to know him as Mr. Hand from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But he was also my favorite Martian on early television, but a great character actor and does a great job in this one too.
And then, and then Hal Smith, who plays the Santa Claus in the bar, he was Otis the Drunk on Andy Griffith.
Yes,
so there's a lot, so there's a lot of great character actors in this. But let's move on then to favorite scenes. We talked about some of them, but Aaron, what's a favorite scene that you had?
I mean, of course the end, because I love happy endings, but the most powerful scene in the movie for me was when she gives him his, for the listeners, in the apartment, sometimes people leave things behind, and Jack Lemmon either gets rid of them, his character gets rid of them, or has to return them. And he had given, there was a mirror of, Sheldrake's mistress left in his apartment, so he gave it to Sheldrake. Sheldrake gave it back to Fran, and so there's this moment after Fran learns that Sheldrake is having other affairs and that he treats all of his women like this. She's having a panic attack, kind of, in a moment, and she hands the mirror to Jack Lemmon, who then realizes, or Baxter realizes that Sheldrake's mistress is Fran. So you have that whole, everything comes full circle, and it's such a powerful moment because he's obviously realizing, and she's like, and he says, your mirror's broken. And she says, that's the way I like things, just like I am. And it was like, oh, my heart was breaking. It was so powerful. It was palpable.
Yeah. It made Baxter see her for the first time as she really was too.
Yeah.
So for both of them, you know, she's having this terrible moment and he's having this moment of revelation and understanding about who she really is. What I really enjoyed though is he pulls back a little bit at that moment, but then later on it doesn't faze him. You know, he's got such a good heart that, he doesn't care. Even when after she follows through with taking a bottle of pills, he's still head over heels in love with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eric, do you have a favorite scene?
I got several. I mean, sure. For the comedy aspect, that bar, the sort of two bar scenes that, you have on Christmas Eve, just great physical comedy, great funny lines. The way that they're dancing, and when you revisit that bar, is just a hilarious moment. The scenes leading up to that too, that whole Christmas party scene is just, it made me think of the show Mad Men. I didn't really realize that. And I was a big fan of that show when it was on television, how much it borrowed from this movie.
Yes.
From the
physical
look to just this debaucherous, this bacchanalia going on in the office on Christmas Eve. And I love that they ring down to the operators, and the operators are like, there's a party going on up on that floor. Let's all go up there. And they just leave their headsets and the whole thing goes away. So all of those scenes, even just you kind of chain them together, and it's just a really great, fun, energetic part of this movie.
It's so funny because I work in HR at the company I work for, and that whole party is an HR nightmare.
Just the shot of all the things. You're like,
that whole scene is wonderful. And like you mentioned, the where the Miss Olsen, who is drunk out of her mind, you know, confronts Fran with what Sheldrake is doing. And then when Lemon takes McClane into his office to show him the hat, and you know, she's just, you know, so down on herself. You know, that's a great scene. I love I love the first scene that the two of them have in the elevator where they're talking about a cult, because it's just such great character writing. It's a simple little conversation, but you know exactly who these two people are, you know, where she says he's got Lulu and, you know, they're talking about, you know, his 101 fever. And yeah, it's just, it's really, really solid writing there. And I already mentioned before, when Sheldrake is at home at Christmas with his family and they're confronting him about the, suicide attempt. But also I think I love the whole, you know, the whole way that they build up to the suicide and the way that everything is played. She doesn't play it hysterically, you know, she's it's very subtly and wonderfully done. Your heart's breaking for her, and the fact that it all just sort of logically leads up to her going into the bathroom to wash her face and then seeing, you know, the sleeping pills in his medicine cabinet. You know, it's not some kind of weird, dramatic, over-the-top histrionics, and the score is very simple there. I think it's done really, really tastefully, you know, for what it is.
Yeah, and, you know, even having seen this movie, when she opens up the medicine cabinet, there was a part of me that was thinking, oh, she's just trying to see who owns the apartment. She's just trying to read the prescription to know.
Yeah. And also the, even the scenes where with her brother-in-law coming to take her home, that could have been done so over the top and slapsticky, but even that's played for real. Is like, even when he punches out Lemon, you know, it's not like he's coming to start a fight. He's just trying to take her home. But you know, the things that Lemon says out of context just pushes him way too far. And, you know, and, you know, and of course with, the doctor being there and witnessing all that, which confirms his thoughts even more, it's all just so tightly wound and everything just sort of plays up each other so well.
And the great turn at the end of the scene where Lemon gets knocked out or punched out down by the brother-in-law and, you know, says it was all worth it. I would have done it anyway. I mean, you know, there, this guy would do anything then for Shirley MacLaine's character.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was a moment that I thought that that man was going to end up being the jockey husband. And I was like, oh my gosh, the jockey got out of Cuba. I cannot wait to see where this goes. Because at the end, when he throws her out, when Jack Lemmon's character throws her out of the apartment, she makes a comment like, I'm going to tell my husband what you did to me or how you treated me, which I thought was another hilarious line, because it was like, oh, you're going to tell your husband that the man you were trying to cheat on him with treated you poorly.
Right.
So I did. I thought that was going to be the jockey. So I was, I don't know. This movie just, it kept me guessing. I liked that.
Yeah. And also I love the fact that Billy Wilder chose to shoot this in black and white when most directors are still doing color. At the time, because it really speaks to the isolation of all the characters. And like you think about the Christmas party, you know, you would think of all the, you know, bright colors and everything. Everything just looks bleak. And I think that was such a wise artistic decision on his part. And, you know, especially the scenes of Lemon, you know, walking, you know, the streets late at night and in the dark, you know, black and white just makes it a lot more crisp than I think it would have been had it been in color.
Yeah, and I think that the opening shots really set that tone, where you have these shots of New York City and Jack Lemmon speaking over that about the number of people that are in the city. And then just a few short shots later, he's sitting at this desk by himself, and there's all these other empty desks with all these adding machines on it, and he's completely alone. You know, he just told you there's more than 8 million people in the city, and at 5:20 or whatever it was, they all empty out of the building, and he's there and he's completely by himself. And it kind of tells you, it informs you about him and the isolation that he feels a lot of the time.
Yeah. And the whole design of the office too, you know, where it's just row upon row of desks that looks like it goes on for miles. And even once you get promoted and you get your own office, they're bare and there's nothing in them. So you still feel, you know, that kind of isolation and loneliness, you know, the whole set design of the office where it's bustling with people and yet you still don't have any sort of human connection. It's all played so well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, any other favorite scenes or favorite things about the movie before we move on?
I think there's a great parallel. Sorry, Aaron, to jump on you there, but I think there's a great parallel then to the very last scene of the movie where it's really simple. You know, they start off with these huge shots of New York City. There's 8 million people in the city, and then it's two people on a couch playing cards. And I just thought that was really great. I don't know if symmetry is the right word, but the way it narrows down to that point at the very end of the movie was poignant to me.
Yeah, I love the last line. You know, Billy Wilder was famous for never trying to be overly sentimental or overly cheesy with his endings, and so he never really he has Lemon do that. You know, I absolutely adore you to her, and then that wonderful line, "Shut up and deal." There are two people who could possibly get to that point where they're enamored with each other, but they're not there yet. And so they're going to let this build. And so the fact that he didn't end it with, that the orchestra swelling and, the two of them embracing and everything is, and I think that's what makes it timeless. It doesn't really, and it's so between the two characters, he feels a lot more than she does right at this moment.
Yeah. They don't even touch.
Yeah,
it doesn't with a kiss. I mean, it's a bold choice, but it works really well.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, she had just gotten hurt. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had witnessed her pain, so it also I think feels fitting that all of the other men in this movie, with the exception of Dr. Dreyfuss, are very flippant and cavalier about women's feelings. And they obviously have that kind of 60s mentality of like, oh, they're just hysterical, oh, women, calm down. And he very much witnessed this, like her breaking down and crumbling. And so here he is, he's sensitive and receptive to emotion from women the entire movie. And so I love that at the end, like you said, he's sitting there, he's sharing his emotions, he's sharing his heart with her, and she's like, shut up and deal. Like, we'll get there, but I'm not gonna open up and pour out right now.
Right. Yeah, it's really, really, like I said, what Wilder writes characters so well, and he never allows it to break even to get like a satisfying, romantic ending. Looking now, though, at when the movie was released, like I said, it was made on a small $3 million budget, and it ended up making $26 million at the box office. So it really, really did a nice profit, and reviews were great. Except for the few that like called it a dirty fairy tale or whatever like that. But and earned 10 Oscar nominations, won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Sound, and Best Art Direction. So, and actually, I was reading here, the last black and white film to win Best Picture until Schindler's List in 1993. So from then on, it was color. And like you said, Eric, this is really interesting because we had, we're coming off of the Ben-Hurs and the Bridge on the River Kwai's and these big epics winning Best Picture. And now we're getting more into the intimate movie, winning Best Picture. We would still have like Lawrence of Arabia and Sound of Music and a few things around the corner. But this is, as the 60s come along, we're going to see a lot more changes in genre, what the Academy like to honor.
Well, and I think that's what makes this movie really important. I think it was probably ahead of its time for that, by telling this really big story in a really intimate way. And, it's not until you get into the later 60s that you get the sort of silver age of movie making, and you have these directors that are willing to take those chances and can pull back from the big studio pictures. And so you get things like The Graduate, or even like a Cool Hand Luke that come after this that I think owe a lot to this movie.
Yeah, I didn't realize when I was watching it, there were so many aspects of it that felt really familiar as far as plot and characters that I had no idea without seeing this, probably how much was drawn or had inspiration drawn from this film. Definitely.
Yeah. And when you look at the other movies that were nominated for Best Picture, 1960 is a really interesting year because this movie and then Psycho was one of the Best Picture nominees, which changed a lot of things also in terms of censorship and how movies are promoted and released. And then you have a movie like The Alamo, which is also nominated for Best Picture, which probably shouldn't have been nominated to begin with, but it was, big epic. And then you have a movie like Sons and Lovers, which is nominated, which is a big British drama too. We were still, sort of in the British invasion in Hollywood there at the time too. So the 60s are a real mixed bag of different. You've got one foot in old Hollywood and then one foot sort of heading toward the new age that would come later in the 60s. But you're right, Eric. I really didn't think, but a lot of those late 60s movies, The Graduate, all that kind of stuff, really owe a lot to The Apartment because you're really seeing more. And I wouldn't call Bud Baxter an anti-hero because he really is sort of this good guy, who he has an anti-hero image to everybody around him. But where you're really seeing flawed characters as your heroes in the movies, where before that, your hero in the movie was really sort of beyond reproach most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And looking at also at just how the movie's been honored since then, on the American Film Institute's list of 100 greatest movies, it's number 80. On the greatest love story list, it's number 62. And on the funniest movies of all time, it's number 20, which really surprises me that it's so high up on that. I mean, you get some great laughs out of this movie, but still, I leave more with the poignancy. So it's interesting how, this movie, like I said before, is not genre specific whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah. That one seems to be the outlier, the number 20 on the comedies.
Yeah.
And 80 all time, that might be low for me, on a personal list. I would put this up in the upper half of the 100, certainly. And probably break the top 30 for me.
Yeah, I think so too. But sometimes, I don't know if it's maybe too simple of a movie where it doesn't stand out as much as some movies on the top half of some people's lists. But yeah, to me, just based on the performances and how fresh the story still is, I think it's a top half movie.
Yeah.
I could see that. I think you probably hit the nail on the head, Brandon, is that it is. It's pretty simple. There's nothing flashy about it. Not that it's not memorable, but it's not exciting.
Right.
So I could see how it could get kind of lost in the shuffle if the top tier of that is more of your fancier movies, your fancier
show. Right. So it's a matter of taste, still the movie is still highly regarded, and unlike a lot of, we talk about on our thread a lot that, a lot of Best Picture winners don't tend to hold up as the years go on. It's kind of what's trendy in the moment, but there's a handful that have, held the test of time. And I think The Apartment is one of those. Also, 8 years later, a Broadway musical was made out of The Apartment called Promises, Promises, which is a score by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, which featured a lot of trendy music. And then it was just done back in 2010 with a very successful Broadway revival that had Sean Hayes in the Jack Lemmon part, Kristen Chenoweth in the McLean part, and Tony Goldwyn from Scandal in the Fred McMurray part. It's not in your upper tier of Broadway musicals, but it was enough to where it warranted a revival at some point. But as we get to our closing here, Aaron, final thoughts on The Apartment.
Okay, I am going to say this. I love The Apartment. I think everyone should see it. I think it is one of those films you need to see. It's beautifully understated and poignant. But one of the things I noticed, and I guess I'll include this in my final comments, but I felt a real familiarity in the score, like reminding me of Tom and Jerry. And I don't know if that's because it was the same studio, both MGM.
Possibly.
I noticed that and I was like, gosh, I feel like I'm hearing a lot of things of like, not of Tom and Jerry, but it just kept bringing me back to Tom and Jerry. And when I look, like there's a lot of overlap between when Tom and Jerry was running and they were in the same studio. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm looking, let's see, the composer of the score is Adolf Deutsch, who was at MGM most of his whole career. I wonder if he did write some Tom and Jerry at some
point.
Probably.
Yeah.
I didn't pick up on that.
No, I didn't either. I didn't either.
I was like, am I crazy? Why is this film, like, why am I thinking of Tom and Jerry when I watch this?
That's great. Yeah. Eric, final thoughts on The Apartment?
Yeah. We've touched on them all here. So I'll summarize it. Really well written movie and performers that are all great performers at the top of their game in this one. So absolutely, it's worth a watch and a discussion. And let's not go back there. Let's not go back to the 60s where, you know, the men were treating women that way. It was disgusting, and I'm glad this movie was there to shine a light on it.
I thank you, because actually I was going to say, wait, I do have one more final thought. And yeah. if I think it's a great movie to look at and to not necessarily get angry over how women were treated, but to use it to say, look how far we've come in our relationships. Look how far we've come in how women and men collaborate and view each other in the workplace. And not that there's not still more work to do, but I think it's easy sometimes when we are wherever we are to say, why aren't we doing more? Why aren't we better? Why aren't we further ahead? But like, really, when you go back and say 50 years ago, this is a time capsule of how women were treated.
Yeah.
And a raw one. And so, like, we've come a far way and we're still going.
Yeah. And that's what I love about movies, the fact that we have a century of movies now where we can look back and look at these time capsules that take us back there, and you can have the same human experiences that people that lived 70 years before you. Yeah. And see that, you know, see what's changed and what hasn't. And the fact that this movie did come out and really spoke to the issue that was going on at the time in a very powerful way is pretty special. And I think that's why this movie does hold up. And it's just, yeah, like you said, Eric, it's actors at the top of their form. It's exquisite writing. And it's a movie that doesn't define a certain genre. And like you said, Aaron, it's not exciting. It's not edge of your seat type of movie making, but I don't think there's a part in it that really creaks or is slow. I think every scene has a purpose. And there's a freshness to it. And I think it has to do with the right people were cast in the right roles, and the acting is still fresh. And so, yeah, I think definitely this Oscar season, if you're wanting to go back and watch previous Oscar winners, I think this is one of the ones that would be the best one to go back to. So, yeah, we've come to the end of our January classics here. I'm so glad you two joined me once again for this. The next month, Lou and I have talked. I think we're going to discuss Godfather Part 2, because he and I discussed Godfather at this time last year. So it'll be time to circle around to that. So that'll be exciting. Eric, you've got some stuff going on. What do you have going on?
Yeah, I'm doing some acting. So in Springfield, Illinois, you can find me at the Hoagland Center for the Arts, starting on January 31st, in the complete works of William Shakespeare, Abridged.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Aaron, Aaron, are you going to be on any more podcasts this month?
I don't think so. Not that I know of. Are we doing an Oscar?
We'll do,
I don't understand how the
Oscar spotlights will be coming next month, probably.
Okay, yeah. Then I think I'm going to be on that, because I'm like, cool, Team Rocket Man all the way.
So. Absolutely, yeah, that's fun. So yeah, I think this is it for me for the month. But yeah, I'll be back with some Oscar spotlights and then Godfather 2 hopefully next month. So thank you both for joining me here. This has been great. Yeah, and so once again, as we close out here, I am Brandon Davis.
I'm Erin McCabe.
And I'm Eric Flick.
And we will see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.